Well, thank you. Thank you all. It is customary on these occasions for the honoree, having endured the praise, to give an account of him or herself. For me, this task is complicated by having been the chair of EPS for 20 years. To the extent that I merit this attention, it's at least partly for that. And the burden wasn't very heavy. I have had throughout the support of our trustees, an inordinately distinguished group, a sensible and loyal board, financial backing, and above all in Taya and her predecessors, but I have to say especially in Taya, above all in Taya, an efficient, competent, reliable, and in every other way excellent director and staff. I'm sure that in some ways over the years we might have done more, but the central mission of EPS has been to provide a venue for the initiatives of its members and a forum within the economics profession for a range of issues, war and peace preeminent among them, but not exclusively, that bear on our society directly and that the larger profession is somewhat prone to neglect. In a rising sea of bellicose propaganda, it is sometimes an achievement to keep a small island above the waves. And here I do want to say a word to Stephanie Kelton, who's not able to be here, who's both snowed in and sick, she has my both sympathy for not being here, and she sent me a note saying she was heartbroken, and also my complete support as things go forward. I need to say a few words about some of the speakers and some members of the host committee. Sandy Darity, my roommate on our arrival at our Marshall Scholarships in England in 1974. Richard Parker, who is as much a brother in the strict family sense as anyone not actually born to that role could possibly be. Richard Kaufman, who protected me from the wraths of Proxmire, as Pat Malloy will know, but Paul Manchester will remember, as well as saving my bacon at the Joint Economic Committee just more times than I can count. Sasha Nekipelov and Luis Carlos Bresser Pereira, Eugenia Correa, and I have to also mention Alicia Giron, who are voices of public spirit and sensible policy through the deep crises in their countries. Linda Bilmes, also not present on account of snow and flu, a relentless accountant in the highest sense of the costs of war. Jeff Sachs, our discreet, efficient fellow staff guy, ally, in the battles of the Athens Spring, led by Yanis Varoufakis of unmatched integrity and courage. Joe Stiglitz, a thought leader mugged and radicalized and untiring ever since. I have to tell a small story because it was very good the first time. On his 60th birthday, which coincided with my father's 95th, I got the instruction from my dad to say, tell Stiglitz he should look forward to the day 35 years from now when he shall finally have achieved his mature voice. So that's, and there was the evening I went as her date with Molly Ivins to the induction, her induction as a fellow of the American Academy of Arts and Sciences. And I bumped into an economist I always liked and admired, a certain really pioneer in the study of international inequality, a guy by the name of Robert Summers. And he greeted me with the remark, we have a similar problem. You have a father, I have a son. like his uncle Ken Arrow, our first co-chair along with Larry Klein, Larry Summers has been a loyal supporter of EPS all along. So I want to acknowledge that. My father was the first honoree of these dinners. It was not my suggestion. And I will say that as I go along, I'm more and not less proud of his work and his example, and glad to be responsible for coming, carrying forward to a certain degree both his ideas and his principles. For someone who passed on 12 years ago, he maintains an impressively aggressive publication schedule. 3 books this year from Princeton University Press, plus a brand new and massive volume of previously unpublished letters. It's not bad at all. And next year, the Affluent Society will appear for the first time in Russian. So it really is something to to think about as you make forward planning in your lives. But especially relevant to EPS were his constant warnings against nuclear brinkmanship, a legacy in part of the bombing survey, which he directed in 1945, his years of campaigning against the Vietnam War, which is an exceptionally close part of my growing up, and his faithful advocacy of detente diplomatic engagement and common interests with what was then the USSR. These were convictions from which no amount of scorn, disdain, or exile from the corridors of power ever deterred him. My own career in economics has been a long succession of lost causes and curious pursuits, beginning in the mid-1970s with the high policy of congressional oversight of monetary policy. The Full Employment Act of 1978, just at the time when the economists were deciding that this was absolutely impossible and a bad idea, and the dual mandate, which somehow managed to survive until it actually came to be recognized as having been useful. Standing with Robert Eisner against the NIRU, with Nikki Caldor and Jim Tobin against monetarism, against rational expectations, against computable general equilibrium and dynamic stochastic general equilibrium models, and all those fancy fads, with Wynn Godley for accounting rules and stock flow consistency, with Hyminsky for inherent instability and financial fragility, with Luigi Pazzanetti on capital theory, cost-determined prices, and development driven by learning. It's really hard to think of a theoretical issue in which I haven't taken the unpopular position. Once listening to Bob Solow give an excellent paper, this was actually at your 60th birthday, Festschrift. It was entitled Dumb and Dumber in Macroeconomics. I leaned over to a Yale classmate who was present and remarked that I had always thought that if one could only close one's eyes and ears for 30 years or so, all of this stuff would just go away. He agreed. He said it was an excellent time to enter public service. It was Ernesto Zedillo, who had been president of Mexico at that point. My research contributions combine 2 distinct predilections for low prestige activity. With respect to subject, inequality was so unfashionable when it caught my attention that I remember an advisor at Yale remarking that to study it was like watching the grass grow, a subject that nothing ever happened. And with respect to method, there is nothing less fashionable in economics than working with the numbers, with the data, especially boring, old, low-tech administrative data grouped by regions or sectors or industries of a type plagued by arbitrary category schemes and long superseded in the professional imagination by sample surveys, tax records, and even randomized controlled trials. And yet, working patiently with this data over 20 years or so, my students and I have managed to demonstrate that reliable measures and estimates of inequality can be calculated, permitting the creation of dense, consistent historical data sets covering practically the whole world, practically on an annual basis, whose components reveal in fine detail the patterns and sources of rising, sometimes declining inequality, and whose common patterns across countries and continents and through time generate a compelling case that the driving forces behind increasing inequalities are the monetary regime, the breakdown of Bretton Woods, the debt crisis, the reduction of interest rates and commodities boom after 2000, debt and debt crises and debt deflations, especially important, afflicting the poor and the small far more drastically than the rich and the large. And in this way, we feel we've laid a foundation in the evidence, a peculiar thing for economists to be interested in, but in the evidence for inverting and upending the economic ethos of the past 30 years. That is to say, for rooting the economics of distribution, which is supposed to be the province of markets, of production functions, of supply and demand, of technology and skill, of rooting it instead in a very firmly Keynesian monetary macroeconomics operating at the global scale. A global macroeconomics of distribution for the age of financial globalization. In this way, we've managed to place ourselves so far athwart the contemporary mainstream that there is actually no category, no code in the Journal of Economics literature for what we do. The macroeconomics of inequality simply doesn't exist, let alone the global macroeconomics of inequality, if you look at the taxonomic schemes of the economics profession. Truly, the ability to define the categories is an awful power. And I'll finish on another unfashionable note, but one which is, I think, very pertinent to this society, to this organization. When Catherine the Great chartered the Free Economic Society, of which I'm a proud member, back in 1765, she gave it the symbol of a beehive and the motto, bon oeil, useful. It strikes me that this remains the proper charge for an economist. Very few of us here have the capacity, the tools, the grounding in theory and history and suitable methods to hope to pretend to the achievements of great science. History generally be kind to the pretenses of the past dominant generation of our profession in that regard. But the economists of the generation before that, and I hope the economists of the generation to come, who grappled with depression, with war, with the awful challenge of keeping nuclear peace, were in important cases quite different. They were useful. Some of them mentored this organization. That's why it exists. And when the Soviet Union collapsed in the 1990s, some of them tried to foster a smooth transition as opposed to the ideologically driven and corrupt calamity that occurred and that has given us much of our present politics. They understood, as I did, I was working a bit in China in those years, that a safer world requires shared prosperity and mutual respect, not dreams of empire and the power of intimidation. To be useful in the world today, we all need to hold to this view. To do so is not to approve of any particular regime. It is to recognize the imperative of peaceful coexistence as the only viable foundation in a world caught between climate change and the nuclear button. Kennedy said it at an American university in the summer of 1963. We all share this planet. We breathe the same air. And we are all mortal. Economists have a duty to face history, the history of that period in all of its half-hidden and unspeakable mysteries, no less than any other, and to face reality and to make ourselves useful. EPS exists for that purpose. And as Auden wrote, just to wrap up with a voice greater than mine, defenseless under the night, our world in stupor lies, yet dotted everywhere, ironic points of light flash out wherever the just exchange their messages. May I, composed like them of eros and dust, beleaguered by the same negation and despair, show an affirming flame. But I don't want to end quite on so somber a note, because as part of the mission to comfort the afflicted, we must also afflict the comfortable. And in each society, we simply have to confront and face down the powers that be. So rather than ending with Auden, I will close with Kipling, who was writing of the visit of a member of Parliament by the name of Paget to India, I suppose, in the 1890s. In the Philadelphia cold, this poem is perhaps out of place because Paget couldn't tolerate the Indian heat. And he fled the scene, and Kipling ends his verses with these immortal lines. "And I laughed as I drove from the station, but the mirth died out on my lips as I thought of the fools like Paget who write of their eastern trips, and the sneers of the traveled idiots who duly misgovern the land. And I prayed to the Lord to deliver another one of them into my hand." Thank you very much.